"You look awful, Leah. What's going on there? Why were you up all night? Is everything okay?"
Martha's image froze on the screen. Her face didn't move, but her voice continued. Then the screen popped and her mouth caught up with her words. Leah sighed. She rubbed her eyes with her finger and thumb.
"It's a long story, Martha. What a horrible night." "Why? What on earth happened?"
"The kids are gone. I mean, disappeared." Martha's mouth dropped open. The screen stopped again with her face frozen in her startled expression.
"You mean the twins? You can't find them?"
"No, all the kids." The words tumbled out of Leah in a trembling voice.
"The twins, Ira, Elena, her friend, and a lot of other kids."
She sucked in a deep breath.
"Oh, Martha, I don't know what's happening. I don't understand, Leah. You called the police?"
A bitter laugh escaped Leah's throat.
"Oh, yes. The police have been here. Local police, state police, the FBI. They've been here all night, Martha, all night, asking Mark and Roz and me questions. Questions like it's our fault, like we're hiding something from them, like we know something we're not telling."
"Oh, wow. It sounds like hell. Do you want me to get off? I could Skype you some other time. Or I could email.
No, it's fine. Actually, it's good to have a friend to talk to. I can't see straight. I'm so frazzled and worn out. But it's good to have a friend."
"Well, where do they think your kids are?
Do they think it's not just my kids? There are maybe 70 or 80 kids missing in Sag Harbor, Martha."
"Huh? Well, that's insane."
Leah rolled her eyes.
"Insane, but true. At first, the police thought it started here. You see, a bunch of kids were hanging out in our guest house in back."
70?
"No, not 70. A few. Several. I don't know. Mark and I went out last night and..."
"Are you sure you want to tell me all this now? You look so tired and..."
"I don't understand it, Martha. They're just gone."
"Where would they go? How could they all sneak off together? It can't be a mass kidnapping. Whoever heard of that?"
"What did the police think? The FBI?" "At first they didn't believe us. There's been some other trouble here with Mark, and we had all these totally upset parents calling us and coming over all night, expecting Mark and me to know where their kids were.
Angry at us. I mean, they blamed us for..." "And no trace of any of them? No clues at all?"
"Not yet. The Sag Harbor police station, they started getting call after call, all from frantic parents reporting their kids were missing. So they finally caught on it wasn't just Mark and me, it was happening all over town.
And so..."
"But that didn't stop them from searching our house and tearing up the guest house. I don't know what kind of clues they expected to find. A map leading them to the kids? A ransom note for 70 kids? I...
"Take a breath, dear. This must be so horrible for you. I can't believe what you are going through."
"No, you can't."
Leah wrung her hands.
"Elena is so sensible. I can't imagine. Well, I'm sure they'll all be found soon. Such a big group of kids can't stay hidden for long, can they?"
Martha leaned toward the camera.
"Have the police considered this might be a big prank?"
"Huh? A prank?
You know, one of those mass jokes people dream up and spread over the internet."
Leah shut her eyes.
"No. No one is treating it as a joke," she said in a whisper.
"Well, I don't think I'm going to tell you why I Skyped," Martha said, rubbing her cheek. "Oh, wait, maybe I better. Actually, as I think about it, what I called to show you might help."
Leah swallowed. Her throat felt dry as dust.
"Help?"
Martha nodded.
"I've been doing some photo research. You know, that's what I do for a living. I promised you I'd do some checking."
Leah nodded.
"I remember. Did you find something interesting?"
"Interesting, yes," Martha replied. "But not good news, Leah. In fact, it's totally disturbing."
Leah rolled her eyes.
"Oh my God, Martha, what did you find out?"
"Let me email you the photos. I think you'll understand why I wanted you to see them right away."
"Okay, send them to my Gmail account, Martha. We can talk about them as I look at them. But what did you find?
What is so disturbing? Just wait, I'm sending them now. There are 3 JPEGs in all.
Leah watched Martha's fingers move over her keyboard. Her expression was tense, almost bitter.
I am really sorry to burden you with this, Leah, especially with the hell you're going through. I hate being the messenger, really. James and I care about you. We think you did such a brave thing. I mean, adopting those boys. But you need to see these photos.
Martha blinked and typed some more.
Also, James and I, we kept something from you. We kept a big secret. We thought you'd be better off not knowing. We did it for your happiness, Leah, but the secret, I guess I just have to come out and say it. It's making us feel too guilty.
What the hell, Martha? What are you talking about? Such a big fucking mystery? Maybe this isn't the best time.
Did you get the photos, Leah? You should have gotten them by now. Check your email. I'll just wait.
Leah slid the mouse and opened her inbox. Yes, there was the email from Martha. Leah clicked twice to open the attachments. She waited for them to download, watching the little line slide across the screen. Her heart started to pound. She clicked again. The Picasa program came to life, and a thumbnail photo appeared on the screen. She clicked it and watched as it sprang up full size. A black and white photo. A beach scene?
No. Is it Cap Le Chat Noir?
Yes,
Martha's reply in a soft voice.
Oh, wow. I see. It's after the hurricane. All the houses are down and the trees, I see.
She saw several forlorn people huddled in the foreground, fuzzy and out of focus, and near the camera, standing together, one with his hand around the other's shoulder.
Yes.
The twins. No mistaking them. Daniel and Samuel, standing close together, surrounded by the hurricane's destruction.
Martha, I see the twins. Take a good look, Leah.
I am taking a good look. The twins are standing there together after the hurricane. They're holding on to each other and looking very alone and forlorn. Her eyes scanned the photo.
I don't see anything else, Martha. Am I missing something? Why is this photo interesting? Well, you notice the photo is in black and white?
Yes, so?
It wasn't taken after the hurricane here last month, Leah.
I don't understand.
The photo was taken in 1935, the day after the hurricane of 1935.
Chapter 59. The morning went by in a blur, and even 2 cups of strong black coffee at 11 didn't wake Mark's mind. Half an hour earlier, he had lifted his head, not recognizing where he was. It took him a few seconds to remember he had fallen asleep after 5 in the morning on the couch in the den, the soft couch, his favorite napping couch, in the clothes he had worn to Nestor Bridger's house. The police, the angry, frightened parents, they hadn't left till 5, and then, his head throbbing, he had collapsed on the couch. But who could sleep with Ira and Elena and the twins gone, missing, and at least 70 other children? And after an endless night of the phone ringing nonstop with frantic parents at the other end, and police and FBI and who knows what invading every corner of his house, and the questions, the accusing stares. Could they possibly think he had kidnapped 70 kids? Where would he keep them? In the basement? In an upstairs closet? Somewhere around 3 in the morning, they asked if he wanted a lawyer. He'd gone into a long rant. He should have held it in. But the wine and the exhaustion, not to mention the anxiety, made him open up and tell them how stupid they were to think he had any answers or anything helpful to say or anything to do with the disappearance of the kids. Maybe his rant encouraged them to leave. No. Now he remembered. More angry, frightened parents showed up at the door, and the round of questions grew even more intense. He pictured the 2 Sag Harbor officers he'd become very acquainted with, Pavano and Pinto. They'd been pushed to the back, too low on the ladder to speak. They watched the whole thing, leaning against the living room wall, occasionally muttering among themselves as their superiors. Who was that big guy, Franks, who paraded back and forth with his Glock hanging out of his holster? Asked all the questions. The officers and agents didn't leave until after 5. Mark sprawled fitfully on the worn soft couch, the questions tumbling through his mind, struggling to think clearly about a theory of his own. It wasn't forthcoming. He didn't have a clue. He was just as puzzled upon waking up. And where was Leah? A glance at the clock. 10:30. This is Saturday, right? She must be up in our room. Can she sleep? This is late for her not to be downstairs. Rubbing the dark stubble on his cheeks, he shuffled into the kitchen for coffee, feeling stiff and not at all rested, and in need of a shower. He squinted at a note in Roz's handwriting. Axel, upset by all the noise last night, took him to the beach, home after lunch. Have my phone, call with any news. No news, Roz. He peered through the kitchen window at the guest house, dark and silent. His eyes burned. He suddenly craved a cigarette. Crazy. He hadn't smoked since college. Don't be crazy. Don't give in. You have to be the sane one. Leah printed out the three photos and sat at her desk, gazing at them over and over. The first two, the 12-year-old twins in 1935, came as a frightening shock. The twins were 12 in 1935, and 12 today. Cap le Chat Noir. It's the island where the living coexist with the living dead. It can't be. Oh, shit. Oh, shit. Please, it can't be true. She sat in the glare of the monitor, gazing from one photo to the other, screaming at them without even hearing herself, screaming at the beautiful 12-year-old twins, beautiful more than 75 years ago, beautiful today. Oh, shit. Oh, shit. I brought them here. Martha warned me. Mark warned me. Oh, shit, it's all my fault. And then, but I care about them. They made me care about them. She slammed the two printouts onto the desk and gazed at the third one. This photo was not a surprise. She had suspected it. She prayed and prayed it wasn't true, but somehow, all along, Leah knew. Martha had signed off, and her apologies reverberated in Leah's mind. So sorry. Really so sorry. I think I warned you not to rush into adopting those boys. I just had the feeling there was something off about them. Not much of an apology, really. Of course Martha was sorry for the way things turned out, not sorry for providing Leah with the truth. And what did she mean by something off about them? Martha said she would send an email immediately with all the information she had been able to dig up about the boys. It's not good news, Leah. I'm so sorry. I wish it weren't true. I'll send it right now. And as for the third photo, Leah could see even on the grainy Skype image how uncomfortable it made Martha, and how reluctant she was to discuss it at all. James and I hoped we were doing the right thing. After that, Martha made an excuse to end the conversation and repeated her apology, sounding a little more heartfelt this time.
I only wish.
No finish to that sentence. And then she was gone, and Leah sat in front of the screen, her eyes shut tight, but not tight enough to keep the pictures from her mind. And things began to come clear, began to connect, starting with the twins and moving to the murder in the driveway and the murder of Derek Saltzman and the disappearance of Ira and Elena and some 70 other kids. Starting with the twins, who weren't really 12. The twins, who had to be ungodly, evil creatures she had brought home with her. Was it coming clear? Did she have the connections right? It wasn't like she was blaming two innocent, adorable boys with such glowing blonde hair and twinkling blue eyes. She wasn't condemning angels. She was starting to see demons. But I care about them. I have such strong feelings for them. And then Martha's email arrived, confirming her worst, most terrifying fears. She couldn't read it all. Her eyes blurred the words. She didn't want to know the truth, not this truth. She scanned through it, catching phrases that made her heart skip.
Both died in the hurricane. The priest was summoned to perform the Revenue Rite. The priest came too late. They'd been dead too long. He should never have revived them. They brought the evil of the grave back with them. They can kill. They can hypnotize. Like their bodies, their minds never advanced. They are still 12. They lived in isolation on the island. People were afraid of them. They lived by stealing. No one was brave enough to stop them. They waited all these years for someone to take them away. They hate adults. They only care about controlling other children. They never got to be real children, so now they want to be leaders of children, to hold power over children, the only thing they care about.
Leah shut her eyes.
Oh, shit, it's all too much. It's all too horrifying. What will happen to Ira and Elena? How can I face Mark? How?
Martha's words brought another revelation. The thought had been lurking in her mind. The email suddenly forced it to her consciousness.
The twins hypnotized me. They used their powers on me. They made me care about them. My connection to them, that feeling of love that I felt, it wasn't real. They used me to get here. No wonder I've agreed to their every wish. No wonder I never opposed them.
She opened her eyes and shuffled through the three printouts again, as if hoping to see something she missed, something redeeming. But there was no reassurance here. The past and her future held only horror.
Oh, poor Ira and Elena. Maybe there was time to rescue them. She had to try.
Carefully, she folded the three photos in half. She tucked them into the big pocket of her silky blue robe. She heard a cough. Was that Mark stirring downstairs? The aroma of coffee made her stand up. She stretched her arms over her head. Yes, she could feel her heart like a hummingbird in her chest, and the coffee aroma suddenly nauseated her.
Mark has to know.
She glanced at the clock on the bed table. Just past 11. The morning had slipped past, but so what? What did a few hours matter when there was nothing to look forward to but more tears and grief and disbelief and anger and regret? She moved to the dresser, adjusting the robe and tying it more securely, and picked up her hairbrush. She swept it back slowly through her straight black hair. It felt real, the touch of the bristles through her hair, the scrape against her scalp. She brushed for a long time, leaning her head back, appreciating each stroke with a soft sigh. This was real. Nothing else in her life felt as real. Nothing else could be as real.
Oh, poor Elena. Poor Ira. What has Mommy done to you?
She forced herself to set the hairbrush down. Then she took a long, shuddering breath. She fingered the folded-up photos in her robe pocket and murmured out loud,
I'm going to tell Mark now. Face the music, Leah.
Isn't that what her dad always said every time she had to be punished for some crime, large or small?
You did the dance. Now face the music.
Did that make any sense at all? The punishment was always the same. Go to your room and stay there till I tell you to come out. She pictured her brother smirking as she trudged off to her room, red-faced, fists swinging at her sides, ready to face the music. Well, after all the years, now she was really facing the music. She started to the stairs but stopped at the bedroom door when she heard the sirens, approaching sirens, and there seemed to be a lot of them, a blaring concert of sirens, warring with each other. Leah spun around and trotted to the bedroom window. Several dark vehicles squealed up the gravel driveway. She saw the yellow letters FBI stenciled on one SUV. Two Sag Harbor black and whites, two unmarked SUVs, windows blackened, heavy like armored cars. She gripped the windowsill and stared down at them all, her mouth hanging open, uttering small cries of shock. Four or five dark-uniformed policemen lined up in front of the house, standing stiffly a few feet abreast of each other, weapons tensed in front of them. Were those automatic rifles? She recognized the big black state police captain from the night before as he came roaring out of the back seat of an SUV.
Was his name Franks?
Yes. He had a pistol in one hand and motioned to the others leaping from their vehicles to follow him to the house. They all had guns raised, all of them.
Do they plan to kill us?
Mark!
Leah screamed, squeezing the wooden windowsill.
Mark!
Do you hear them?
Finally, she forced herself away from the window. She spun to the doorway, her robe tangling around her, and went running to the stairs.
Mark! Can you hear me, Mark? What do they want?
Chapter 60. At first, Mark thought people were screaming. The sound made him drop his coffee mug on the kitchen table. And as he hurried to the front of the house, he realized they were sirens. And strangely, the wailing cacophony made him angry, because they had just been there, just invaded his house and his life, and he didn't want them back with their foolish accusations and misguided questions and insulting stares. I'm sick of the bullshit. I just want my kids to be safe. Why are they back here? What are they doing to find my kids? Mark clenched his jaw tight and squeezed his fists until his fingernails dug into his palm. And then the pounding on the front door and the shouts shook him out of his anger. He heard Leah calling his name. Turning, he saw her halfway down the stairs, her hand gripping the banister, her eyes wide with fright.
Mark!
The pounding on the door drowned out the rest of her words.
Mr. Sutter, police, open the door!
Barked, just like on TV. Mark pulled open the door. An army of men, it seemed like an army, led by Captain Franks, who came in with his shoulder low like an NFL blocking tackle, pushed into the house. Mark stepped back, blinking at the force of it all. The sheer invasion, the anger. He saw the weapons raised. They forced him against the fireplace. He heard Leah scream,
Mark Sutter, you are under arrest for the murder of Autumn Holiday.
Frank spitting the words in his face, standing so close Mark could smell the coffee on his breath.
Huh? Autumn? What?
Did the words make any sense? Beside him, a wavy-haired cop was reading him his rights from the screen of an iPhone.
Wait, wait!
Mark raised his hands in the air. The cops all tensed their weapons.
What did you say?
His voice shrill, almost unrecognizable, shouting over the droning voice of the cop still reading off the phone screen.
Did you say Autumn? Killed?
He couldn't help it. He pictured her bent over his desk, her hands gripping the edge of the desktop, that creamy white ass moving under him.
No!
A howl of protest burst from deep inside. Two cops stepped toward him menacingly, guns raised. He saw Pavano and Pinto holding back, still in the doorway, as if guarding against any escape attempt. Were there cops outside in case he made a run for it? What a joke. The child psychologist makes a run for it.
How could Autumn be dead? Why? Why Autumn? And why did they think he was the murderer?
I can't believe it.
He felt sick. He grabbed his stomach. He felt the coffee rising up his throat.
Not Autumn.
He let out a long sigh, shut his eyes, and leaned back against the mantel.
No, there's some mistake. Why are you arresting Mark?
He heard Leah's trembling voice. Opened his eyes to see her step warily past Pavano and Pinto into the living room. The officers ignored her and kept their eyes on Mark, weapons tensed.
You don't have to answer any questions until you have a lawyer present, Frank said, the only calm voice in the room. But you can help yourself by...
When was Autumn killed?
Mark interrupted, narrowing his eyes at Frank's.
Last night? You know I was here all night. You were here with me. How is she killed?
Leah asked, moving up beside Mark, gripping his hand.
Her hand is ice cold. She's as terrified as I am.
Our initial report says she was murdered this morning, perhaps an hour or two ago.
His dark eyes locked on Mark's, probing.
Mr. Sutter, if you'd care to cooperate, could you tell us your whereabouts this morning?
My whereabouts? The word didn't make sense to him. He knew he wasn't thinking clearly. The word didn't seem like English.
Did you go out this morning?
Franks rephrased the question. This version sounded more like a threat.
No, I was asleep on the couch in the den. I woke up and made some coffee.
Again, he felt his stomach lurch.
He held his breath, forcing it down.
You didn't go out this morning.
His answer came out in a sharp scream.
No, I fucking told you I didn't go out. I have been in here all morning. Do I have to spell the fucking words for you?
Franks didn't react. He turned his gaze on Leah, holding on tight to Mark's hand.
Mr. Sutter, can anyone vouch for your whereabouts? Can anyone confirm that you were here all morning?
Leah can.
Franks waited for Leah to speak up. Mark saw she was breathing hard. She'd gone very pale.
Actually, I was upstairs in our bedroom. Mark was down here, but I know he didn't go anywhere this morning. You kept us up all night, remember?
So you were upstairs and didn't see him this morning?
Every question Franks asked sounded like an innuendo and a threat. Mark gasped, startled by the anger that built up so instantly inside him.
You should be out finding my kids.
I didn't see him,
Leah started, but... Behind Franks, a state cop dangled a pair of silvery handcuffs in front of him.
You're wasting your time, Mark told him, unable to keep a trembling sneer from his face. If someone murdered Autumn, the real killer is out there. And you're standing here arresting me, a child psychologist who's never even been in a fucking playground fight.
Very eloquent, Franks commented dryly. Listen, Mr. Sutter, cooperate with us now, and we can clear this up very quickly.
Mark blinked.
What are you talking about? What do I have to do?
Leah let go of Mark's hand.
I'm going to call Nestor, she turned to Franks. He's our lawyer. He's in Sagaponic. I don't think Mark should say another word until he gets here.
What do you want me to do? Mark concentrated on Franks.
How do we clear this up? Tell me.
Show us your wallet, Franks said. That's all. Have you got your wallet, Mr. Soto?
Of course I have my wallet.
Franks nodded.
Then will you be so kind as to show it to us?
Mark thought hard.
Where did he leave it?
His brain was so churned up, his stomach rumbled with anger. He could feel every muscle in his body tensed and tight.
Where? Where?
I left it on my desk last night. He started into the hall. Two cops rushed forward and grabbed him roughly by the arms.
We have to come with you, Frank said. You're in our custody, remember?
I know I left it in my office.
Mark let the two cops walk on either side of him. Franks followed right behind. I can picture it, next to the phone. Into the office, a strong breeze rattling the blinds in front of the open window. Mark gazed at the desk.
Autumn, how can you be dead? Who would want you dead? Autumn, you were so beautiful.
No wallet.
He fumbled his hand over the desktop. He shoved a stack of folders out of the way. He pulled open the desk drawer and shuffled through it.
Don't look frantic.
Don't make them think you're frantic. But he couldn't control his hands from shaking. Emotion had taken over. Rational thought always lost out to fear, to panic.
I know I left it here yesterday. I was at my desk and I needed one of my credit cards to buy something over the phone and...
Do you want to search for it in any other room, Mr. Sutter?
Frank's deep voice, mellow and calm.
Sure, he's calm. What does he have to worry about? He's so pleased with himself, so pleased with his false arrest.
Yes, yes, let me look for it upstairs, in the bedroom. Maybe I left it on the dresser. Sometimes I leave it there,
Can I save us some time?
Frank's question made Mark spin away from the desk. He squinted at Frank's.
Save time? What do you mean?
One of the officers handed Franks a plastic bag. It looked like a food storage bag. Frank shoved it into Mark's face. Mark squinted at the wallet in the bag.
Is this yours?
Mark reached for it, but Frank swiped it away from his hands.
No, no, don't touch. It's evidence. Trust me. We saw your driver's license inside. Your Amex card.
A dizziness fell over Mark. No, not dizziness. Falling. A free fall. Like he was dropping down an endless black hole.
Okay, that's my wallet.
Franks nodded to the cop at the office door.
Put the handcuffs on him.
He turned back to Mark, shaking the wallet in front of Mark's face.
Mr. Sutter, your wallet was found this morning in the grass next to Autumn Holliday's front stoop. My advice, sir? Don't say another word to me until your lawyer gets here.
Chapter 61. As the solemn-faced cop moved forward raising the silvery handcuffs, Mark had one of those flashing lifetime moments he had always believed to be only a staple of fiction. The room grew dark, and Franks and the other officers appeared to fade into the wallpaper. A white light formed like a glaring spotlight in his mind, and the images began to whir past. Not of his childhood, not of the history of events that led him to this maddening moment. In the 2-second flash of bright light, The events of his future swept past him, a frenzied slideshow of despair and ruin. He saw a clear picture of his office, now a closet piled high with cartons, his career over, the house empty, his family scattered, bold newspaper headlines bannering his disgrace. He saw the sad faces of Ira and Elena, two hardened, disillusioned kids. And Leah. Where was Leah? Gone? No picture of Leah? And the last image of himself, handcuffed in a tiny gray prison cell, clanging the bars with the handcuffs, pounding out his anger, shouting, "But I'm innocent! I'm innocent!" The light faded. The room came back into focus. And Mark, startled, found himself shouting, "But I'm innocent!"
"Wow. No one ever told us that before," Frank said.
Maybe it was Frank's sarcasm that set him off, or maybe it was the frightening images of the future that flashed before him almost like something in a science fiction movie, or maybe it was the burning outrage that was making it impossible for him to breathe. "This isn't right. I didn't murder anyone. I couldn't murder anyone. I couldn't murder Hewlenberger. I couldn't murder Autumn. My kids are missing. My kids are in terrible danger. Why are they arresting me? Why aren't they finding my kids?" Something clicked in his mind. He thought he heard the snap. It was too much. Too much. Without thinking, he started to move. He saw Leah push her way past the cops in the doorway, and he heard her sharp cry, "It wasn't Mark! It was the twins!" He heard her blame the twins. Yes, he heard her shout to the officers, "It was the twins!" And he saw Leah pull some papers from her robe pocket. But he couldn't stop himself to hear more. He was already moving. He already had the back of the desk chair gripped in both hands. With an animal grunt, he gave the chair a hard shove, thrust it forward on its metal wheels, sent it skidding into the cop with the handcuffs. He saw the seat cushion bounce into the cop's midsection, heard the unsuspecting guy utter a startled groan, and saw him toss his hands up off balance. And then Mark dove to the open window. Both hands on the sill, he flung himself out, swung himself like some kind of circus acrobat. "Surprise, everyone!" He dropped onto his back on the hedge beneath the window, scrambled like a turtle to right himself, arms and legs spiraling at once. And yes, the element of surprise had helped him. No one was staring out of the window yet. As he forced himself to his feet, ignoring the bramble scratches on his back, his eyes gazed around the backyard. No cops back here. The idiots thought he would submit without any trouble to them. He heard shouts and angry cries, heard Frank's deep voice booming from the window,
"Sutter, stop! Are you crazy? Stop or we'll shoot!"
But he was already around the side of the guest house, his sneakers pounding the hard ground into the cluster of trees that bordered the yard. The ground sloped down, leading him into woods thick with ancient oak and sassafras trees, their fat trunks tilted and tangled and hugged by fat evergreen pines. Every sense alert, his eyes darting to find a path through the thickening underbrush, Mark heard no shots. The shouts had faded far behind. He couldn't think clearly. The rush of adrenaline and the blood pulsing so furiously at his temples kept his mind from focusing. He was an animal running to safety. He leaped over a fallen trunk covered in green and yellow lichen, pushed through two pine bushes, stumbled on the thick carpet of dead leaves under his shoes, caught his balance, and kept running. Small creatures scuttled out of his way. Chipmunks? Moles? Over the rushing in his ears, he heard the loud caw of birds high in the trees, and he imagined them calling to the police, reporting his location. He realized he had never ventured into these woods behind his house. This was nature, the uncivilized world, and he was civilized, an author, a father, a husband. But what was he now? Running for his life, his freedom, what was he now? And where was he going?
Chapter 62.
"I think we have a gang or something," Pavano said, chewing the end of his breakfast burrito. "I mean, something organized, don't you think?"
Pinto nodded. He drove past the middle school and turned the patrol car onto Ackerley Street, his eyes surveying the suburban-style houses, the neat lawns and paved driveways.
"Two burglaries on a Monday morning, and it isn't even 8 yet?"
Pinto agreed.
"I'd say it was the same guy."
"Couldn't be just one guy,"
Pavano wiped cheese off his chin with the back of his hand. His eyes were on the sidewalks. Perhaps they could catch him red-handed.
That would feel like an achievement. So far, my life here has been total frustration.
Look at what they took, Pinto. Flat-screen TVs, desktop computers, phones, handheld video games. One guy by himself couldn't boost.
It's the food I don't get,
Pinto burped loudly. He'd already finished his burrito.
I mean, emptying the fucking refrigerators? What kind of thief takes all the food, too?
A hungry one?
Ha-ha, don't try to be funny, Pavano. You know what you are? You are anti-funny.
Yeah, I'm not a fucking riot like you, Pinto, true. Let's try to think about this. He pushed a chunk of scrambled egg into his mouth.
This town has gone crazy, Pinto. 3 fucking ugly murders. All those kids kidnapped. Now we got houses robbed. And
the radio beeped. Where are you, girls? Vince, able to sound harassed in only 4 words.
We're on Ackerley, near the school, Pinto answered.
Good, I got another break-in for you. This one's on Clinton. Woman just got home. Think she saw the thieves running off. Maybe you can catch them. How fast can they run with computers and TVs?
Maybe they have a truck, Pavano offered.
Maybe they have a flying saucer. Get over there.
The patrol car squealed like in the movies as Pinto made a high-speed U-turn. The car rolling over the curb, spinning up grass, then bumping back to the street.
Vince, you send him back up.
Pinto leaning over the wheel, eyes on both sides of the street at once.
You're joking, right? Every other guy I got is with the feds and the state clowns searching for Sutter. They're all over Sag Harbor yesterday, and no one comes up with a footprint or a trace of the guy.
You see the post this morning?
Pinto slowed the car down as they approached the house on Clinton.
Psychologist.
Yeah, pretty good, Vince replied. Hey, don't expect backup for anything. I got 20 more missing kids. Parents are out in front of the station banging on the door like a lynch mob or something. Where are you? You see any kids?
Of course I see kids, Pinto said. We just passed the middle school. I see kids going in.
School's going to be a little weird, Vince said. We got at least 100 kids gone missing.
Maybe there is a flying saucer, Pavano said.
Silence on Vince's end. The radio squealed, then cut off.
There's a woman waving to us on the porch, Pinto said, like we couldn't read her fucking address.
People get upset when their house is robbed, Pavano murmured.
Hey, you know what? You're a fucking genius.
Yeah, and how come you're in a total shit mood this morning?
Pinto grunted.
I guess because everything is going so well in this town.
Pavano shoved the last chunk of burrito into his mouth. The car turned into the driveway.
You know, I don't think Sutter is guilty.
Pinto scowled at him.
Maybe I agree. But no one is asking us, Andy. Franks and the feds got their mind made up. They got the dude's wallet, they got the other 2 murders, and the fucking guy ran.
It's not much when you think about it.
Pavano reached for the door handle. The woman was running down the driveway toward them.
He just doesn't seem the type, you know?
I don't know, Pinto said.
He seems pretty squirrely to me. That wallet thing, does he ever look like he's telling the truth?
No.
And why did he run?
Just saying, Pavano murmured.
It's like a hunch, you know? Only stronger. I think he was totally shocked when he heard about his assistant being murdered.
Pinto grunted in reply. It was obvious he didn't agree. He cut off the engine. The 2 cops pulled themselves out of the car. The woman was tiny, middle-aged, pretty. She was dressed in a white top and white leggings. She was screaming as she ran.
They cleaned me out! The little bastards cleaned me out!
Pinto stepped up to her. He was about 1 foot taller than she. Her streaked blonde and brown hair was wild around her face. He squinted down at her.
Little bastards? You saw them?
She nodded, breathing hard.
Yeah, kids. Bunch of kids. I mean, like, little kids. 8, 9. I screamed and they took off. Little bastards took my new iPad.
Pavano started up the driveway toward the house.
Can we come in? Look around?
Behind him, he heard the radio and the patrol car squeal. He and Pinto both trotted to the car. Pavano got there first.
Vince? Forget the burglary, Pavano. Get out of there.
Why? What's up?
We're onto something. A neighbor spotted some of the missing kids. I need you over there now.
Over there? Where?
They're in the school.
Chapter 63 A buzzer rang and echoed in the line of classrooms down the hall, the signal to start class. But today, no classes would be started. Samuel knew the doors were locked, and the teachers had given up trying to enter the building. A group of seventh graders had been given sentry duty, and they kept watch at all the entrances for any attempt to force open the doors. Of course, the kitchen workers had been greeted warmly and ushered inside. They arrived first, just before seven, to begin preparing breakfast for the kids in the meal program. They soon got over their surprise at finding the new order, the new regime, as Samuel thought of it. The blue arrows were applied to their faces, and they immediately became pliable under Daniel's will. Now they were in their white uniforms and aprons, preparing breakfast as usual, only this time for the new arrivals and for the robbery team who returned from their missions with great appetites. The morning sunlight slanted into the classrooms as kids settled into their new rooms. Some of the light spilled in patches into the crowded, bustling hallway. The mood was cheerful and filled with anticipation for the adventures to come. Of course, Daniel set the mood, sending his signals to anyone wearing the painted blue arrow, and he could alter the mood, change the emotions and feelings of the 200 or so followers simply by changing the direction of his thoughts. Now Samuel followed him down the line of kids who were showing off what they had stolen. He stopped in front of a frail, young-looking blonde boy with a galaxy of freckles across his nose.
"What's your name?"
"David."
"How old are you, lad?"
"I'll be 11 next week."
"Well, I'm impressed, David. 2 laptops, good work. You're going to be on my special electronics team."
Samuel watched as a proud smile broke over the kid's face. Samuel patted the arrow on the boy's cheek, then pointed him toward the computer room, which had been a sixth-grade classroom but now was a storehouse for stolen computers. Samuel gazed down the long hall, crowded with followers, some presenting their stolen items for inspection, a group of new arrivals seeking instructions, a girl who carried her brown short-haired dachshund with a blue arrow painted on the right side of its face, a sixth-grade boy with long stringy brown hair leaning against one wall, softly playing a guitar, several kids hanging back, watching warily as the twins made their way through the patches of dull sunlight in the hall.
"Why did you take these sweaters?"
Daniel asked a lanky red-haired girl with red-rimmed glasses.
"I like the colors," she said, "and I think they're my size."
Daniel motioned with his head toward the girls' hall.
"Go try them on. If they don't fit, put them in the clothing storeroom."
She nodded and hurried off with her armload of stolen sweaters.
"So much to organize, boyo,"
Daniel said, giving Samuel's face a gentle slap.
"You know, bright beginnings, right?" "This school is ours,"
Samuel declared. He pumped his twin a hard high five. His excitement actually made it hard to stand still. He wanted to hop and dance and bounce off the tile walls. What an amazing day. He hadn't felt this alive in many years.
"Daniel may be the match, but I am the fire."
Samuel glanced through the window of the art room. He could see Ira standing at a table with several cans of blue and white paint. He was applying a blue arrow to the cheek of a chubby sixth-grade girl with braces.
"It's so simple. Once the arrow goes on, they're one of us,"
Daniel said, watching Ira work.
"Better than hypnotizing them, my lad. They don't even know I'm putting thoughts in their brain. Ira's getting good with a paintbrush. Ira's a good brother,"
he flashed Ira a thumbs up.
"Do you like some breakfast, Sammy? We've worked hard this morning, but it feels like play, doesn't it, lad?"
Samuel nodded.
"We rule, Daniel. It's what we always wanted. We waited so many years."
Daniel had a faraway gaze in his eyes.
"It's a full school, and we rule. But we've only just started."
Samuel snickered.
"I know your mind, Daniel. I know you want all the kids. All the kids. All. All."
Daniel still had the dreamy look.
"All. It's a start, right? Does it make you feel alive, Sammy? Does it now?"
Before Samuel could answer, someone stepped in front of them. Someone large, blocking their path. Her appearance was so sudden and unexpected it took Samuel a few seconds to realize he was staring at Mrs. Maloney, the principal. She wasn't in her usual school outfit. She had an oversized man's white dress shirt pulled over sloppy faded jeans. Her bird's nest hair was matted in spots, as if it hadn't been brushed. She kept blinking and gazing down the hall, as if trying to force away a bad dream.
"Well, what a surprise, to find so many of my lovely chickadees in school so early. What are you all doing here?"
she shouted over the chatter of conversations.
"Can any of you darlings explain this to me?"
Daniel stepped up to her.
"How did you get into the building, Mum?"
She lowered her gaze to him.
"Daniel, are you here too? And your brother? What are you doing here? Why are the doors locked? Can you be telling me what's going on?"
"But how did you get in?"
Daniel repeated. The principal dangled a ring of keys in one hand.
"I know some hidden entrances. This is my school, don't you know?"
"No, you don't rule the school, Mum."
Daniel spoke softly, blue eyes probing hers.
"We rule the school." My brother looks calm, but I can feel his agitation. "We made a mistake last week. We forgot to paint an arrow on her cheek. We let her get away."
"Daniel, lad, you don't make any sense,"
she said. Her eyes were over his shoulder. Samuel could see her counting, taking a tally of the kids in the hall. They had all grown silent. All eyes were on the confrontation between Daniel and the principal, and the tension was evident in the heavy, ringing hush over the hall.
"Who brought you all here?"
She raised her head and shouted.
"Did someone force you to come here?"
Silence. No one moved now.
"Somebody tell me what this is about. I don't want to punish you all, but you will give me no choice."
Daniel nodded, as if he agreed with her. He signaled to Samuel with another nod of his head. Samuel took a deep breath and started to heat up his eyes.
"Mrs. Maloney seemed like a nice woman. She should have stayed home. Now, she will be sizzling like Irish bacon."
"The police have been notified," the woman shouted. "They are on their way. I saw a crowd of people outside the building. Many of them are your parents, waiting to see you. How many of you would like to go out and see your parents right now?"
No hands went up. The boy giggled. That made several other kids laugh.
"What's funny, kiddos?"
Mrs. Maloney demanded.
"Someone tell me, what's funny?"
The red curtain had started to form over Samuel's vision, but he could see the uncertainty in her eyes, and he saw the uncertainty turn to fear. She tried again.
"Your parents will be so happy to see you. Come on, everyone, follow me. Let's all go outside."
She motioned toward the front doors and took a few steps, but no one made a move.
"You don't understand, Mum,"
Daniel said, almost in a whisper.
"We rule the school."
Her eyes widened in surprise.
"Daniel, you? You're behind this bizarre behavior? You and your brother? I don't believe it.
You are good lads, I know."
"What?"
And then Samuel turned his eyes on her, aimed the full heat of his power at her forehead. He misjudged, aimed a little too high, and her hair caught fire. That bristly steel wool hair burst into red flames. She screamed and grabbed at her head with both hands, and he lowered the beam to her forehead. The skin peeled open, blistered, and split apart.
"Her head is opening up like a flower blooming."
She raised her hands and pressed them against her burning face, dropped heavily to her knees, and Samuel sent the fire to the top of her head, a powerful blast that made him dizzy for a second, made him quake, his knees threatening to buckle. Her head burned like a torch. Her eye sockets lay black and empty now, and her nose was gone, just a dangling flap of charred skin.
"The eyes burn so quickly. How quickly a face melts."
The fire moved down her neck, crackling, popping, setting the shirt ablaze. She toppled forward. Her charred head hit the hard floor with a smack, her big body a beached whale, a pile of kindling.
"She ended her life as a bloody bonfire."
Samuel shut his eyes, kept them closed, waiting for them to cool, listening to the sizzle of Irish bacon. A hard pounding, a deafening boom jarred him from the pleasure of the moment. He turned to Daniel as a deep voice on the other side of the front door bellowed.
"Open up! Police! Open this door! Now!"
Chapter 64. Pinto and Pavano arrived at the middle school less than 5 minutes after they got the call. Pinto bumped the black and white onto the curb and muttered, "Ah, shit." Pavano saw the crowd move toward them, maybe 20 or 30 people. Parents? How the fuck did they get here before we did? The two cops had no choice. They climbed out of the car. The shouted questions were like an attack.
Are our kids in there? What did you hear? Who brought them here? Are they hostages? Is this a kidnapping? What's going on? What are you going to do?
A jumble of frightened voices. Pavano spotted three people, two men and a woman, at the side of the building. It took him a few seconds to realize they were about to climb into an open classroom window.
Hey, stop! Pavano took off, shouting as he ran. Back away now! Back away from that window!
A young man in gray sweats turned to face him.
We want to get our kids out. We'll get your kids, Pavano said,
struggling to catch his breath.
But we don't know who's in there. If this is a hostage situation, you could put your kids in even greater danger.
The three parents stared hard at him, a tense face-off.
Step back. Let the police handle this. We have to figure out what is happening here.
The parents finally relented. Pavano led them back to the sidewalk. The parents formed a circle around the two officers. The women were dressed in shorts and t-shirts, some in morning run or workout sweats or tights. A few of the men appeared dressed for work. A very tanned man wore a black swimsuit and flip-flops and had a blue beach towel over his shoulder. A gray-haired couple held each other around the waists of their maroon sweats, tears rolling down their faces.
Must be grandparents.
Pinto crossed his arms on his uniform shirt. He had a distant look in his eyes, as if he was willing himself away from this. Pavano raised his hands for quiet, but the shouts and frantic cries only grew louder.
We know how worried you are, but don't do anything crazy. We're going to take care of this. Your kids will be safe.
He told them what he thought they wanted to hear. He glanced up the lawn at the school building. The red morning sunlight glowed in the long row of classroom windows. No sign of anyone near the school or at the double doors of the entrance. Pavano let out a sigh of relief as, sirens blaring, a convoy of cars pulled onto the grass. He saw Frank's in the first car, an old Ford Crown Victoria, black, with New York State Police emblazoned in yellow on the door, followed by two more state cars and then the feds in three unmarked Escalades. The state guys went to work, pushing back the crowd, herding them off the lawn and toward the street. Jogging along the sidewalk, his brown suit jacket flapping around him, Franks waved both hands, motioning Pinto and Pavano toward the building.
Let them know we're here.
As if the sirens weren't a tip-off. Pavano trotted after Pinto, up the long stone walk to the front entrance, past the bare flagpole, past an abandoned red backpack in the grass, the flap open, obviously empty.
What's the plan here?
Pavano said, a heavy feeling rising in his stomach as they stepped into the shade of the three-story school.
We just knock on the door and they come out?
Beats the shit out of me. Pinto picked up the abandoned backpack, inspected it, and tossed it back onto the grass.
Do I know what the hell is going on? Kids go missing on Friday and Saturday, all found in school on Monday. Does that fucking make sense? Why would kidnappers take 100 kids to school? It's fucking insane.
Pavano stared hard at his partner. Pinto was already red-faced and breathing hard, beads of sweat glistening on his broad forehead despite the coolness of the morning.
You read the reports from yesterday. Just about every parent said the same fucking thing. Their kids vanished without a word. No sign of violence. No break-ins. The kids were just gone.
I read them all, Pinto said, eyes on the entrance.
And what was that shit about blue arrows on their faces? Just like Sutter's kids, remember? They said it was a school thing. The principal told them to do it.
Pinto grunted.
It's an alien thing, Andy. The kids were all abducted by aliens. They're slaves on another planet by now.
Pavano snickered.
Neighbors saw kids coming into the school this morning carrying laptops and TVs. No way they can be on another planet if they're robbing every house in the neighborhood.
Just saying. Pinto didn't smile. A shadow passed over them. Cawing birds swooping overhead made Pavano glance up. The clouds overhead were jagged and torn, as if a big cloud had been shredded into long pieces. The sky is frenzied and chaotic as everything down below. Pinto took the front steps two at a time. He tried one door, then the next.
Locked.
He raised both fists to the double doors and pounded against the wood.
Open up! Police! Open this door! Now!
Before they could detect any response, Frank stepped up behind them, badge dangling on his suit lapel, followed by four federal agents with FBI stenciled in red on their gray flak jackets. Franks raised both hands in a halt signal.
Hold up. We've got to deal with these parents first. Make sure they're out of the way in case there's trouble.
Trouble? Pavano wondered what the captain was expecting. Franks rubbed the scar on his chin.
If this is a mass kidnapping or a hostage situation, we might face weapon fire. There could be explosives.
The rest of his words were drowned out by the shouts of the parents. Ignoring the outnumbered state cops, they surged forward, stampeding to the bottom of the wide concrete steps.
We want our kids! How are you going to get them out of there?
Who locked them in? Who brought them here?
What are you doing? You're just going to pound on the door?
The parents glared up at the officers, their faces frantic, voices shrill. In their utter confusion and helplessness, they all shouted at once, anger rising over their fear.
Pavano saw one of the state cops hand Franks an electric megaphone, and Franks began to plead for quiet.
I need you to step back. Quiet, everyone. Quiet. Everyone, please be quiet and step back.
His requests were unheeded. The shouts grew angrier and more desperate. Pavano saw more SUVs pull up and more frantic parents running to the steps. A young couple tossed their bikes to the grass and came jogging to join the others. As Franks continued to plead, his voice washed back at him as if by a powerful wave. Two officers flanked him. They assumed a defensive position, their faces hard, and unholstered their revolvers. That's what it took to quiet the crowd. Pavano let out a long whoosh of air. He hadn't realized he'd been holding his breath.
What now? Their guns are drawn? They're gonna fucking shoot the parents?
Pinto murmured, close to his ear. Pavano shook his head.
Can't blame the parents for being in a panic. If that was your kid in there?
Pinto spit in the grass. They stood just behind Frank's. Pinto crossed his arms in front of him. Pavano stood stiffly, hands clenched into tight fists.
We have no information at this time,
Franks declared, his voice magnified like the voice of God booming over the nearly silent crowd.
The exact wrong thing to say, Pavano thought. What a fucking jerk.
And yes, it ignited the parents again, cries of alarm and a barrage of frantic questions. When the cops finally restored quiet, Franks took a different tack.
We are going to get your children out of there, and we will get them out safe and sound.
Some muttering, but the reassurance seemed to calm them a little. Gazing down at the crowd from the steps, squinting into the spreading glow of sunlight, Pavano recognized Leah Sutter. She stood near the back of the crowd, dark hair down around her face, arms crossed, wearing a pale blue sweater. Next to her, he spotted Sutter's sister, Roz. She stood with her hands on the shoulders of her squirming little boy, leaning over him, trying to get him to stand still. Leah Sutter stared straight up at the school building, frozen like a statue.
She has four kids in there. What must she be feeling? What horror is she going through? Four kids.
Pavano had read the report taken by a state cop late Saturday night. The Sutter kids were reportedly in the guest house out back with some friends, and all vanished, kids and guests, leaving no trace. He pictured the twin boys she and her husband had adopted from that hurricane-devastated island. What a tough introduction to American life those poor boys were getting. He swallowed.
Especially if their new father is a murderer.
And then he couldn't stop the gruesome images from playing through his mind. The young girl with her stomach burned open, lying face down in a pile of her own intestines. If only he hadn't seen that. And the boy with his head completely burned off. And the man in the car. If only he hadn't seen the three victims. Then he wouldn't see them in his dreams, or when he closed his eyes for a moment, or when he woke up. Every day, he saw them every day.
I'll probably see them forever.
And if Mark Sutter was the murderer, Pavano wondered if Mark Sutter was haunted by the murders too. He claimed he thought about the first murder night and day.
Really?
Did he think about the victims and think about how he had burned them? Burned them open like some kind of monster from hell. But Pavano knew Franks was wrong. He knew Mark Sutter wasn't the murderer. Sutter didn't have it in him. Pavano could read him. He didn't have the anger. He didn't have the insanity. He didn't have the balls. And there stood Leah Sutter, on the edge of the crowd of frantic, shouting parents, silent and still, standing so stiffly beside her sister-in-law. No kids, and no husband.
Your husband isn't a murderer. I know it. So why did he decide to run?
Pavano knew the cops were no closer to finding the murderer of those three people than they were to knowing how 100 or more kids disappeared from their homes and presumably were locked in this school building. And thinking this, with Frank's fading into the background of his mind, yammering on through his megaphone, Pavano suddenly felt the full weight of all his regret. It came so suddenly, and as such a surprise, he felt his knees start to give as the heaviness swept down over him. All the wrong choices he had made in his life suddenly confronted him, just as the crowd of parents confronted Frank's. Such bad timing, but he couldn't shake it off. If only you could command your mind to think what it should be thinking. But instead, he thought of Sari, and then back to Susanna, how he messed up his marriage. It could have worked if he had tried harder, if he hadn't been such a fucking jerk. And Sari, again, Sari, what the fuck? What made him think he could step into the past and just claim her as if he hadn't walked out on her before? Didn't he move to the Hamptons to step into his future? Well, she fucking showed him you can't go home again. All the wrong choices, all wrong. Every decision of his life. And now what? What was happening? A young blonde woman with a red polka dot bandana around her neck had stepped forward and was talking to Franks. Their conversation quieted the crowd as the parents strained to hear.
You're a teacher here? Franks said, lowering the megaphone.
Yes, I'm Rhea Seltzer. I teach 8th grade science. I arrived the usual time, a little before 8, with everyone else.
She gestured to some other teachers who stood apart from the parents.
The door was locked. We tried shouting for the custodians. We thought it was a mistake.
Then what did you do?
Franks asked, brushing a fly from the broad shoulder of his jacket.
We didn't know what to do. We looked for Mrs. Maloney, the principal. She usually arrives about the same time we do.
But you couldn't find her? Is she here?
Franks shouted into the megaphone.
Mrs. Maloney, are you here?
We saw her car. It's a white Camry. It's in the teacher's parking lot. But we couldn't find her.
Seltzer pointed to a short man with a mane of curly black hair.
Mr. Monroe had her cell number. We tried it several times, but we only got her voicemail.
One of the cops leaned forward and said something in Frank's ear.
Are the teachers always the first to arrive?
Franks asked.
No, the woman answered. The cafeteria workers get here first. They have to make breakfast for the meal plan kids. They arrive before 7:30.
Where are the cafeteria workers?
Franks demanded, shouting as if at a rally. He raised the megaphone.
Are you here? Please step forward.
Their cars are here, but they're not out here, the teacher Monroe called out.
They must be inside,
Seltzer suggested. Pavano thought about it. The food workers arrive and are ushered in. Then the doors are locked. Are they hostages? Were they let in to cook for the kidnappers? For the kids?
Franks had to silence the chatter of the crowd again. Pavano turned to the building and gazed along the row of windows. The morning sun, yellow now and slowly rising over the trees, reflected in the glass. He couldn't see anyone inside the classrooms. The third window from the right was open, but no sound came out.
My son has a cell phone, but he's not picking up,
a man in a dark blue running suit said.
I found my daughter's phone in her room. She would never leave the house without it.
I've been trying to call my daughter all morning. No answer. I don't understand it.
My son is new in this school. Why did they take him? Are you going to get them out, or are you just going to stand there asking questions?
That shout made Francis' face twitch. He was a big, imposing man. He radiated strength, athletic prowess, and power. But his stance wasn't impressing this crowd of frightened parents. They wanted action. Why weren't the police storming the building, or at least trying to make contact with whoever was inside? It was obvious they thought Franks was stalling, that he had no clue what to do here. And they were right. Pavano's eyes surveyed the crowd. He stopped at Leah Sutter, still standing near the back, her arms crossed tightly over her chest. She hadn't moved. Did she know where her husband was hiding? Sutter had eluded all three police departments for 2 days now. A man in a white t-shirt and khaki shorts came along the sidewalk, walking his French bulldog on a leash. He stopped in surprise and stumbled over the fat dog when he saw the crowd.
Is this a school event?
Some parents turned to set him straight on what was happening.
Has anyone received a ransom demand?
Franks boomed, sweeping the megaphone from one side of the crowd to the other.
Has anyone received a communication from anyone inside the school building?
The answer was a definite no. One of the state cops said something to Franks, pointing to the school. Franks let the megaphone slide to the ground. He motioned Pavano, Pinto, and the other cops forward.
Can't wait to hear his brilliant plan, Pinto muttered. He probably wants to blow the fucking school up.
That would get us home in time for lunch, Pavano replied, eyes straight ahead on Franks.
Pinto stopped him.
Whoa, partner, you're not developing a sense of humor, are you? Did you forget? I'm the sarcastic one.
Sorry, Pavano murmured. The strategy just seems kind of obvious to me. I mean, there's an open window, right? So we fucking go in and see what we find in there.
And if the kidnappers start shooting?
Pinto, do you really think they're kidnappers? Kidnappers who grab 100 kids, take them all to school, and make no demands?
Pinto shrugged.
What else could it be, Shipbrain?
We're going in, Franks announced. Weapons in hand.
The weapons order drew loud howls of protest from the crowd. Franks motioned toward the open classroom window.
Ignore the crowd. If you see someone holding the children, shoot first. Just don't hit any kids. Shoot anything else that moves.
What movie did he get that line from? Guns drawn, the feds in the FBI flak jackets strode to the open window. Pavano had to squint. The windows all gleamed as if the sunlight was coming from inside. Pavano, Pinto, and three other local cops followed, almost as an afterthought. Pavano glanced back at the street and saw Big Pavano in his blue-black captain's uniform standing by himself. His cap was tilted over his head. His gun was holstered. He was shaking his head as if he disapproved of the whole thing.
Where the hell has he been? Pavano asked.
Pinto spit on the grass.
The captain likes a big breakfast.
Franks probably hasn't kept him in the loop, Pavano suggested. It's a miracle the feds are letting Franks run with this.
Waiting for him to hang himself, Pinto muttered.
They were approaching the open window. Pavano still couldn't see any sign of life inside. He felt his chest tighten. Each step made him feel a little more tense and a little more alert.
What kind of madman kidnaps 100 kids? What is he doing to them in there?
He pictured the boy with his head burned off.
Oh, God. What are we going to find?
Here we go, he muttered without realizing it. Pinto leaned close.
I've been in some tough situations, he said softly. I always think of a line from a country song I heard.
He poked Pavano.
You're a country music guy. You probably know it.
Pavano didn't reply. He waited for Pinto to tell him what song.
God is great, beer is good, and people are crazy.
Pavano grinned.
Yeah, I know that song, Pinto. It ain't a song, Andy. It's my Bible.
Pavano heard the French bulldog start to bark, as if warning them away from the window. Frank stepped up beside the feds. Cautiously, he raised his head to the window and shouted inside.
Can anyone hear me? We're coming in.
Pavano and Pinto tensed their weapons.
We're coming in, Frank shouted again. Police! We're coming in! Police!
Pavano could see only the back of Frank's head. From his vantage point, the class